This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Why do you read? Is it for pleasure? Is it for amusement, insight, or knowledge? Well, Wendy Lesser has written a book called Why I Read, The Serious Pleasure of Books. It's divided into sections on character and plot, novelty, authority. The final chapter is called In Conclusions. Wendy Lesser is the founder and editor of the literary magazine The Threepenny Review and the author of 8 books of nonfiction and a novel. She joins us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me on, Ross.
Aside from the fact that you run a literary magazine, so it's kind of your job, why do you read, Wendy Lesser?
Well, as I say in the book, I pretty much read because it's a compulsion. I'm the kind of person that if I sit at the breakfast table and there's a cereal box, I have to be reading the back of the cereal box. So I try and read things that are, for the most part, better than cereal boxes. And I read things that I like, and if I don't like them, I throw them down. But I don't think there's any moral dimension, any sort of instructive improving of other people that I can pass along advice reason why I read. I read for pleasure because I like to and I can't not read.
You had a great sentence about the experience of reading. Nothing takes you out of yourself the way a good book does, but at the same time makes you aware of yourself as a solitary creature. What did you mean by that?
I guess I was at that point contrasting reading to most of the other forms of entertainment with words that we have these days, the internet and email and tweeting, but also TV and movies and things that are we tend to experience in groups, and something is in a way broadcast to us either individually on our computer or in a group movie theater, and then we take it in a sort of public way. And reading is not that. Reading is just you and the book, and it's very intimate in that sense, and that's one of the great things about it.
See, but I never feel solitary when I'm reading a great book. I'm so swept up in it, I don't even think of myself. I'm kind of gone.
True. I mean, I suppose I didn't mean lonely when I said solitary. Mm-hmm. I meant self-determining, and you are getting to turn the pages, and you are getting to decide how long you sit there with the book, and you are the person that the book is speaking to. You know, you're the sole recipient. You're not by yourself, of course. You're right. The book is there, too.
You are not talking about cereal boxes, nor magazines, nor newspapers when you talk about the kind of reading you discuss in this book, are you?
True. I'm not talking about any of those, although I am, to a certain extent, talking about nonfiction and forms of fiction like science fiction and mysteries that are not generally classed with literature, and I'm classing them with the kind of literature I read. So something that was originally in a newspaper, I suppose, could turn into the kind of book that I write about and why I read, but I just, at the moment, can't think of a single example where that was the case.
Well, In Cold Blood started out as a magazine article.
Well, it started out as a magazine article.
Yeah.
That's
And it started out as a newspaper article that Truman Capote clipped and then turned it into that book.
That's true.
I'm talking to Threepenny Review editor Wendy Lesser. Her new book is called Why I Read. There's plenty of references to the pantheon in your book, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Proust, but you spend, as you mentioned, a lot of time writing about mysteries, which are generally scorned amongst serious literary people. First of all, why do you think they are scorned, and why do you take them more seriously?
I think they're scorned in part because the people that market mysteries want everybody to feel that a mystery is the kind of trash you can swallow easily. It's like dessert. That's a way of peddling mysteries to make them sound like they're not serious books. So it's a two-way street. That is, the academics take this attitude, but so do the marketers of mysteries and the people in bookstores that place them, you know, amongst themselves as mysteries and not with other books of literature. I'm not saying, of course, that every book that's a mystery is a work of literature, but nor is every literary nonfiction work a great work. And I would say that I just as often find excellent workmanlike prose, good, solid characters, and other things I like in literature in mysteries as I do in regular fiction books that are published. And I more often find good plots. The kind of people that write mysteries do a little work, and they don't just sort of allow the words to fall out on the page any way they want. They figure it out beforehand, and I appreciate that.
I think you spend more pages on the Scandinavian mystery writer Henning Mankell, the author of the Wallander series, which has been made into TV shows in Scandinavia and Great Britain. I think you spend more pages on him than anybody else. Why is that?
Well, Actually, I think that's probably not true. I think if you add together all the Dostoevsky passages in the book, and if you add together all the Henry James passages, they probably outweigh Henning Mankell in total. But you're right that as a sequential discussion, I spend a long time on Henning Mankell, and that's partly because I had to make an argument, in a way, as to it's in a chapter that otherwise is about translation. I had to make an argument about the nature of the writing and how it came through in a kind of unobstructive, transparent form. And I also had to make an argument about what was great about these mysteries. As you say, when I'm talking about the high-class authors that everyone acknowledges as high-class, I'm not having to create a defense for them. I'm just having to make my own little comments.
You write of great television, shows like The Wire or the Italian TV series Best of Youth, as kind of raising the question of what is literature. Why do they raise that question?
Well, because, for instance, Shakespeare really only exists on the stage. I mean, most of my exposure to Shakespeare has been reading him on pages, but I really only get the feeling of what the play is supposed to be like when I see it in a beautiful staging. And that's even more true of other playwrights. And so when I started thinking about that and thinking about the fact that the words on the page were not the whole thing, that the rest of the way in which it's created matters deeply to literature, at least theatrical literature, I thought, well, why don't TV programs qualify in the same way? And certainly everybody I know thinks that The Wire is one of the great works of recent American art, you know, that most books don't compete with it.
And you could, I suppose, read the screenplay or the text of it. It wouldn't really be the same, though, would it?
It would be tedious beyond belief. A friend of mine who is in the Screenwriters Guild recently received a bunch of things so he could vote on the Oscars, and he got the screenplay for All Is Lost. Have you seen All Is Lost?
No. What's it about?
This takes us far afield, but this is the Robert Redford movie where he's lost in the middle of the ocean, and he's all by himself on screen for the whole movie. And there are about 10 words in the entire movie. And so my friend said, the screenplay is the normal length of a screenplay, but it's all narration. It all describes what he's doing with his hands and his head and everything else.
We're talking about Why I Read. It's the title of Wendy Lesser's new book. She's the editor of the Threepenny Review. You have a chapter called Novelty, and in that chapter you write about the type of writer who gives novelty a bad name. What type of writer are you talking about, and could you name names?
Well, of course, I prefer not to name names among the living, so I'm not going to do that. And in general, I don't read those kinds of books that give it a bad name among the living. But we all, you know, try at certain points to read, for instance, the French writers of the first part of the 20th century who did odd things with dropping E's in every word and experimenting with words on the page. Oh, I suppose E.E. Cummings, in a sense, using all small letters, no capitals, that kind of thing. It worked for E.E. Cummings, but all the imitators are terrible. And there's a certain way in which an emphasis on new form for its own sake, just trying to do something because it's different and no one else has ever done it, without thinking about what do you have to say that demands this new form, just the new form in itself is an irritant if it doesn't have that deeper reason.
We don't just read on books anymore. We read e-books, tablet computers, even telephones. I understand there's some Japanese fiction written specifically for telephones. Has that changed reading?
I'm sure it has, and it has a little bit for me. Just before I was waiting for you to call, I was reading a mystery on my cell phone because that's the only thing I have with me that I haven't read. I have my book, but I've already read that. And I read on the cell phone when I'm commuting on a subway or when I'm waiting in a doctor's waiting room or something like that. And I read on an iPad a lot. But I think the nature of reading is different on those things, maybe only for people my age who grew up with a printed page. For me, I can remember things I've read on a printed page in a different and more solid way than I can if I've been flicking my finger across the screen and each page disappears. They sink in better for me if they're on a printed page. But I can't say that will be true for everyone. And I imagine the generation that grows up with the screen will treat it just the way I treat a book.
Sometimes we don't read at all anymore. More and more people are listening to audiobooks. How does that alter the way we approach literature, to listen rather than read?
Well, I have a funny little incident that I describe in the book where I was setting up my iPad with the young woman at the Apple store, and we were talking about what you could do with the iPad, and she said she preferred to listen to audiobooks because When she read a book with her eyes, she sometimes found she was losing track and her mind drifted and she had to reread a sentence and figure out what it meant. And I was quiet for a second and then I said, that's how reading works. There's a way in which the audiobook keeps your attention on it in a linear fashion and you're just stuck with it. And it goes forward whether you do or not. And at the same time, it presumes you are going forward with it. But reading on the page frees up other parts of your brain so that you can daydream and get lost. And you do have to force yourself to come back occasionally. And that's interesting. That's an interesting realization. That gets back to what you and I were talking about at the beginning, about realizing that you're there, that you're a self present in this process.
Wendy Lesser's new book is called Why I Read. And how did answering for yourself that question, why I read, did that teach you anything?
It did, but nothing that I can summarize easily, and that's why the final chapter is called In Conclusions rather than Conclusions. In other words, I did end up discovering which books put themselves forward toward me and needed to be discussed, and that told me something about how I choose what I read. And I ended up realizing, you know, the subtitle of the book is The Serious Pleasure of Books. I ended up realizing what was serious about that pleasure, what made it something other than just eating candy or, you know, playing a game. But you'd have to read the whole book to hear what I learned, because it's all in the individual instances. There is no generality that works for every case.
Wendy Lesser, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.